Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Crime with Holly. I'm your host, Holly, and I am happy that you're here and back and ready for another episode. Today's episode is a great reminder for us all that you should never lose hope for a case to be solved. With the advances in science and technology, more and more cold cases are being solved, and today's case was solved after 39 years, thanks to genetic genealogy. Anytime I see that a case has been solved through genetic genealogy, it gives me so much hope for all of the families that are left without answers. So without further ado, let's get into all of the details of today's case. Today's case is on the murder of Michelle Martinko. Michelle Marie Martinko was born in Cedar Rapids, Iowa on October 6, 1961. She was quite the miracle baby because her parents Albert and Janet had struggled with 5 miscarriages before Michelle came along. Michelle had an older sister named Janelle that was 12 years older than she was. So growing up, Michelle was just kind of an only child at home. With her sister being so much older, by the time that Michelle was school-aged, Janelle had moved out of the family home in Cedar Rapids. Cedar Rapids is the second largest city in the state of Iowa, and it's best known for its manufacturing, arts, and culture, and food. It is the world's largest corn processing city, and back in the 1960s and 1970s, Cedar Rapids was considered a safe place to raise your family. The Martinkos were like most American families. The kids would play outside until the streetlights came on, they kept their front doors unlocked, they trusted their neighbors. The world back then felt like a much safer place to be in comparison to today's world. Of course, we know that's not the case. Evil was lurking in all corners. We just didn't realize it. So when Michelle was born, her sister Janelle said everyone was just so happy. She was, I think, the final piece to the family puzzle. And after so many losses to finally have their baby that they tried so hard for, Janet and Albert adored her, and she was so loved. At the age of 12, Michelle was diagnosed with scoliosis, which is a sideways curvature of the spine that can cause the spine to look like an S or even a C shape. And because of that, she had to wear a brace that went from her neck to her hips. Naturally, being 12 years old, wearing a brace like that made her insecure. She felt very different and self-conscious about it, and she really struggled over the next several years. But by the age of 14, things were looking up for Michelle, and she was able to do away with the brace and continue about her life. And that is when she really flourished and things began to change for her. Michelle was growing into a beautiful young woman. Now, Farrah Fawcett was big during this time, and Michelle had the gorgeous long blonde hair that she styled like Farrah's. She also was big into dressing up, and she was always dressed so fashionably. And Michelle's sister Janelle and brother-in-law John said to 48 Hours that Michelle was just blissfully unaware about how much attention that she was getting from young men. She was just living her life. According to Little Village News, Michelle excelled in school while attending Cedar Rapids Kennedy High School. She had great attendance, was considered a loyal friend. She was very active with choir. She performed in theater productions and made the baton twirling team as a sophomore, which was practically unheard of, apparently. At the age of 15, she caught the eye of a boy that was a year older than she was, and his name was Andy Seidel. They met while they were out roller skating at the local roller rink, and sparks began to fly almost immediately. Andy was a handsome young man with a flashy red convertible sports car, and he quite literally swept Michelle off her feet. The two were together for 2 years before they broke up, and from what I gathered, it was Michelle who broke the relationship off because she didn't want to be in a committed relationship. Andy did not take the breakup well, and from the sounds of it, he kind of spiraled. He wanted to know Michelle's every move, who she was talking to, who she was dating, why she was seeing that person, and tried to stay in communication with her friends so that he always had a sense about what she had going on in her life, and he just wouldn't stay away. After the breakup with Andy, Michelle dated Mike Weirich briefly, and of course, Andy wasn't happy about that. But from what I could tell, their relationship was brief and wasn't very serious. In December 1979, Michelle was 18 years old and a senior in high school. She had dreams of studying interior design at Iowa State University after graduation. She had her entire life ahead of her. On December 19th, 1979, Michelle attended a choir banquet at the downtown Sheraton Hotel, where she wore a cute knee-length, thin-strapped black dress. After the banquet, she invited Jane Hansen to go shopping with her at the Westdale Mall on the south side of Cedar Rapids. This mall had just opened less than 2 weeks before and was a hot spot for teens and young adults to shop and hang out. The mall sported all kinds of popular stores like JCPenney, Gap, Sam Goody, Montgomery Ward, and so many others, and it also included a four-screen movie theater. Michelle was on a mission to purchase a new coat, and she had brought $186 with her to spend. Unfortunately, Jane Hansen had to decline the offer to join because she needed to get home to catch up on some homework. Michelle went to the mall alone and parked the family's tan 1972 Buick in the northwest section of the Westdale Mall parking lot near the JCPenney. While inside the mall shopping, she ran into a few people that she knew, saying hi before going into some stores. She also ran into Tracy Price, and he saw that she was openly carrying her cash around in her hands. He told her that she should probably put the money away, since that was a lot of money to just be walking around holding in your hands and that someone could rob her. Michelle put the money away and kept about her shopping, but she ended up deciding against purchasing the coat and was getting ready to leave the mall when she saw her friend Kurt Thomas, who was working at a men's clothing store. The two were happy to see each other and were chatting it up. Kurt walked Michelle to the mall exit where he watched her bundle up and waved her goodbye as she headed out into the dark parking lot. Briefly, she turned around to look at him at the door, where she smiled her big, beautiful Michelle smile and said goodbye once more. Kurt smiled back and turned to go back to work, not knowing that he would be the last person to see Michelle alive. When Michelle didn't return home that night, her parents called the police at around 2 a.m. to report their daughter as missing. And it was just 2 hours later that the family Buick would be found still in the parking lot of the Westdale Mall. When police approached the car, they discovered a brutal and bloody scene. Inside the car, they found the lifeless body of 18-year-old Michelle Martinko lying on her back, slumped over the passenger seat and leaning against the car door. Michelle had been stabbed 29 times in the face, neck, and chest. She also had defensive wounds all over her hands and arms from when she tried to fight off her attacker. In the back seat of the car, they found some items that she had purchased at the mall, and her purse still contained a large amount of cash inside, leading the investigators to believe that robbery wasn't a motive. Because there was no blood on the ground outside of the car, they believe that Michelle had approached her car, put her belongings in the back, and climbed inside. While sitting inside of the car, they think that the attacker came up and opened the door, pushing her further into the car and began the brutal attack. Upon further examination, it did not appear that Michelle had been sexually assaulted, and with the amount of stab wounds and their placement to her face and neck and chest, the authorities were under the assumption that this was a personal attack and likely someone that knew Michelle. Now, there was no murder weapon found at the scene, and they also didn't find any kind of fingerprints. They did, however, find that there were some rubber glove impressions that had been left inside of the car in her blood, as well as outside of the car in dirt, which means that whoever did this to Michelle was ready and prepared to conceal their identity, leaving behind no fingerprints. The mall parking lot also did not have surveillance cameras, which doesn't come as a surprise because remember, this was 1979. Life seemed safer back then. They didn't have CCTV footage on every corner like we do now. There also had been no witnesses to the violent attack. The police had nothing really to work with and were left to assume that this was a personal, planned attack thought out by someone who knew Michelle. So they started questioning everyone. And in small towns, rumors run rampant, and a lot of people were looking at Andy Seidel or Mark Weirich as being potentially involved. Mark was brought in for questioning, even though at the time of Michelle's murder, he was 100 miles away at college. And at first, they didn't feel like he was being truthful with them. They slapped down the crime scene photos in front of Mark, demanding answers that he couldn't give. And Mark, who was innocent, tells 48 Hours how horrific and hard that was for him to not only be questioned about killing Michelle, who he adored and thought was just the sweetest person in the world, but to see those crime scene photos like that. I am sure that those images will be forever ingrained in his mind. Mark's alibi checked out, and again, he was 100 miles away at college, but he remained a person of interest anyway. Andy Seidel was also interviewed, and he told the police that he had actually seen Michelle at the Westdale Mall that night. He told them that he had been there purchasing Michelle a Christmas gift, and that the two saw each other and chatted and had been friendly. He said that after shopping at the mall, he went home, and his alibi was confirmed by his mother, who also said that she was at home with him after the mall had closed. As we've seen in many, many true crime stories, moms will lie for their children, and even though his mom said he was at home, the police didn't buy it and kept Andy Seidel as pretty much the number one person of interest in this case. Andy's behavior also after the murder really stuck out to people. He was an absolute mess at Michelle's funeral. And according to a woman named Gail Dawson, who was close friends with Michelle, Andy was almost inside of the casket at her funeral with his arms around her and was just sobbing uncontrollably. Andy then turns to Gail at some point during the funeral, and he tells her that he needs to know who Michelle loved when she died. Did she love him or did she love Mike? Who did she love when she died? The small town rumor mill was heavily leaning towards Andy being involved, and Michelle's closest friends and family all thought the same. He seemed like the only logical explanation. And that maybe he felt like if he couldn't have Michelle, no one else could. Michelle's mother even wrote in journals about several people that she thought had been involved in her daughter's murder, and Andy Seidel was at the top of her list. But she also considered Kurt Thomas, the person who saw Michelle before she walked into the parking lot, as a potential suspect as well. Police also questioned Kurt, and it was during this questioning, the day after the murder, that Kurt had even learned that Michelle had been murdered. which he took hard, and even still to this day, he carries a lot of guilt over the fact that he didn't walk Michelle out to her car that night. Had he done that, maybe in his mind, she would still be alive today. But even though Andy was at the top of the suspect list, police had nothing to link him to the violent murder of his ex-girlfriend. After high school, Andy left town and joined the Navy and moved on with his life. And as the years went by and the case goes cold, anytime the murder of Michelle Martinko came up, Andy's name would as well. With nothing linking anyone that Michelle knew to the murder, police were forced to continue their investigation and consider the possibility that this was a random attack. Year after year, the local news stations would put out a piece about Michelle and her murder in hopes that it would generate new leads. Over 100 people were interviewed during the investigation, and tips were called in nonstop in the beginning. But eventually the calls would stop, and all leads had been followed. Sadly, Michelle's family, who were left grieving, were victimized over the years when prank callers would call the home making fun of the situation. Michelle's mom would answer the phone, and the person on the other line would say, "Mother, mother, it's Michelle," and then laugh. People would pretend to be the killer calling and taunting them. And it's just so awful that even to this day, families deal with this crap on the regular. I don't know what kind of sick person out there gets some sort of gratification from this. I don't know what the motive is to rub salt in an open wound. It's just disgusting that people like this exist in the world. We deal with enough sickos, but to add people who taunt victims and their families is just beyond words. Now, Michelle's family never thought that her case would be solved, and the case was handed from one investigator to the next, and they all came up empty-handed. Now, as we know, science, technology, DNA, all the things have evolved since 1979. When Michelle was murdered, DNA testing wasn't a thing, and wasn't until sometime in the 1980s with the first criminal case using DNA in 1986. So in 2005, a man by the name of Doug Larrison was in charge of Michelle's case, and surprisingly, he actually went to high school with Michelle, but they weren't close. Either way, though, when he took the case over, he felt this strong sense of responsibility to help get this case solved. While combing over all of the information, he found that a detective earlier had sent blood scrapings that had been taken from the gear shift of the car out for testing, but nobody had followed up to get those results, and the results had sat untouched in the stack of files for this case. When Detective Larrison was going over everything and found that report, he made a huge discovery. Not only did this gear shift have the DNA on it, it had male DNA on it, leading Detective Larrison to believe that the killer had likely cut himself during the violent attack and left his very own blood behind at the scene. After this discovery, Detective Larrison then sent Michelle's dress that had been collected and safely secured in an evidence locker for all these years out for more testing. And on that dress, they found a spot of blood that had a full male DNA profile that was consistent with the male DNA profile that was found on the gear shifter. Talk about striking gold. They felt like if they could figure out whose blood was left behind on her dress and car, they would have their killer. According to the Gazette, the DNA was then uploaded into CODIS in hopes that the killer had been charged with a felony and already in the system. I think everyone knows what CODIS is, but if you're fairly new to true crime, CODIS stands for the Combined DNA Index System. Pretty much, it's a computer program that was founded by the FBI that stores and compares DNA profiles from convicted criminals, crime scenes, and missing people nationwide. When they loaded this unidentified male DNA into CODIS, they did not get a match. Police also started asking for swabs from everyone that had previously been interviewed, including Michelle's two ex-boyfriends, Andy and Mark. Everyone waited on pens and needles for the results to come back, certain that they would point to Andy Seidel. And when the authorities told the family that Andy had been ruled out, they were all shocked. By this time, Michelle's parents had both passed away, and they went to their graves believing that Andy had taken their daughter's life. This was incredibly hard news to process for her remaining family. Who else could have wanted Michelle dead? One by one, the DNA tests came back, and one by one, each person was ruled out. With no new leads, all possible suspects having been tested, the case went cold once again and remained on ice for another 10 years.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who pieced together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Michelle Martinko's case had been at a standstill for far too long. 36 years since her brutal slaying, and 10 years since DNA evidence proved that a male DNA profile had been found on her dress, the case was once again passed off to a new set of eyes, this time landing in the lap of Detective Matt Denlinger in 2015. What's really neat about this case is that Matt's father, Harvey Denlinger, had worked on this case back in 1979 when he helped interview several of the high school students, and he also helped in canvassing of the area when the police were searching for a suspect. Matt Denlinger was only 5 years old at the time of the murder, but growing up, he remembers hearing about the case and would often visit the Westdale Mall. And he told the Gazette that the whole city was affected by this case, and he was warned by his parents when he would be dropped off at the mall to not wander around where he shouldn't be and to not go outside of the mall until it was the designated time for him to be picked up. When Matt Denlinger took over the case, he knew that he wanted to continue pursuing that DNA evidence. It was about 8 months into him working on the investigation that he knew that he needed to switch directions. At this time, they were trying to swab pretty much everyone at random and compare their DNA, and each time they were coming up empty. And according to the Gazette, it wasn't until Detective Denlinger bought his wife an Ancestry DNA kit for Christmas that an idea struck. And it wasn't even his idea to begin with. His wife, Nicole, asked him, what if you could do this with the Martinko case? So he calls up the officials at Ancestry and he asks them if he can take his suspect's DNA profile and upload it into their system, but they declined and said that's not what their services provides. But the state crime lab then suggested calling private labs. And that's when Detective Denlinger got in touch with a lab in Utah, and they pointed him in the direction of Parabon Nano Labs that is located in Virginia. This company helps law enforcement use DNA to then create a prediction of what a suspect might look like based upon their DNA profile. This includes skin color, hair color, eye color, facial structures, and so much more. And they call this process snapshot. And this process is not cheap to do. It costs about $5,000 per sample to do, and police departments aren't filled with unlimited funds to just follow these types of ideas on a whim. Detective Denlinger had to create a presentation to present to his supervisors in an attempt to sell them on this idea to allow him to use department funds for this snapshot DNA process, and he was convincing enough that they agreed. According to the Gazette, by 2017, they had these images back that had been generated from the DNA profile, and they shared them with the public in a press conference. After those were pumped out into the media, the department received hundreds of new tips and leads, and the authorities were once again busy collecting new DNA samples from potential suspects. In total, they collected 125 new DNA samples, and still, none were a match to their suspect. But what they did learn was that their suspect was likely a white male with blonde hair and blue eyes. Another year would go by, and then the Golden State Killer was arrested in the spring of 2018 with the help of genetic genealogy. And as soon as Detective Denlinger heard how they solved the decades-old Golden State Killer case, he knew that this was going to be how he would solve the Michelle Martinko case. Detective Denlinger then worked with Parabon Labs again, and they took the sample from the snapshot images to upload into GEDmatch.com. Now, this website can be used by anyone, and you can upload your DNA file, and people do this to help them kind of build their own family tree if things like Ancestry is not working. But GEDmatch is also used by law enforcement to help solve crimes. Anyone can sign up for free to use GEDmatch, and according to their website, you can choose to opt in and enable law enforcement to solve violent crimes and exonerate the falsely accused. So if you've previously done Ancestry or 23andMe, you can download your DNA profile and upload it. I will link the website in the description of this episode, so if you want to look more into it, you can. After uploading the suspect's DNA into GEDmatch, in July 2018, they got their report back that there was a DNA match for a relative. This relative was a woman named Brandy Jennings, and she lived in Washington State. From there, they were able to build her family tree using birth records, marriage records, genealogical records, gravestone records. You named it, they used it. And it was in October 2018, they finally narrowed it down to three brothers who were second cousins to Brandy, who lived in Iowa. Their names were Donald, Jerry, and Kenneth Burns. Now, they had to learn everything that they could about these three brothers, and they were pleased to find that all three of them were still alive. They started to game plan how they would collect their DNA to compare to the DNA found in Michelle's car and on her dress. And Detective Denlinger made sure to keep his lips tight. He only let a select few individuals know what they were doing and that they had narrowed it down to these three guys. They didn't want it to get leaked out to the press at all that they were on to something, and they didn't want these guys to somehow be tipped off that something was coming. All three of these men grew up in Manchester, Iowa, which is about 45 minutes drive from Cedar Rapids. Two of them still lived in Manchester, while one brother had moved to Davenport. Detectives couldn't find a connection to any of these three men and Michelle, nor did they find a connection to the Westdale Mall. All three brothers were business owners, and none of them had a criminal history. So they tried their best to decide which brother to start with, and they decided Kenneth seemed like the most likely of the three. Detectives followed Kenneth around for the better part of a day, and come lunchtime, he stopped in at a golf course for a bite to eat. After leaving, the detectives collected the straw he had been drinking from and sent it back to the Iowa State Crime Lab in Ankeny. They made the Martinko case top priority and had results from the straw back within a few days. Kenneth Burns was not a match. Detectives then traveled to Davenport to follow Donald around, where they collected a glass he had used, as well as a toothbrush that they had retrieved from his garbage at home. He also was not a match. So they went back to Manchester to start watching the final brother, Jerry, who they originally thought was the least likely to have committed this murder. They followed Jerry to a pizza ranch, which is a buffet-style restaurant, and they watched and they waited. While there, he was using a straw with his drink, and as soon as he got up to leave, the detectives moved in quickly, swiping the straw out of the cup before leaving themselves. They rushed that straw to the crime lab, and this time, after 39 years of waiting, they got a match. Instead of immediately arresting Jerry, Detective Denlinger, as well as another retired detective who had previously worked on the case, traveled back to Manchester on December 19th to visit with Jerry to see what he had to say. They arrived at Jerry's business and walked in and introduced themselves to the now 64-year-old Jerry Burns. They cut straight to the chase and told him that they worked for the Cedar Rapids Police Department in the cold case unit, and they wanted to know if he had heard of Michelle Martinko's case. He agreed that he had seen it on the news, and when shown a picture of Michelle, they asked him if she was someone that he recognized or had seen before. He said no, and he was very calm in his demeanor. They then told him that they were there because they had a warrant to collect a sample of his DNA. After collecting their sample, they told Jerry that they knew that the sample that they took from his mouth was going to match the DNA that they had found on Michelle Martinko's dress. And Jerry just sat there very blank-faced and said, "Oh, really?" Now, I don't know about y'all, but if someone told me that a sample that they just took was going to match a DNA that they had for a murder case, I would have told the authorities that they were out of their damn minds. I would have said absolutely there was no way, shape, and form that I had been involved. I would have been absolutely dumbfounded and asking a bazillion questions and demanding answers on why they would have even considered me as a suspect. But Jerry Burns, he just sat there just quiet. He was straight-faced, and all he said was, "Oh, really?" And then he finally, very calmly asks, "Why would that be?" I feel like an innocent person would have reacted way differently to hear that they were a suspect in a nearly four-decade-old murder case. Maybe you guys can weigh in on how you would have reacted in the comments. I just know I would have been completely caught off guard and would have been demanding answers right then. But Jerry remained calm. The authorities picked that specific day to visit Jerry because it marked the 39th anniversary of Michelle's murder. They asked him what day it was, and he said December 19th. They asked him if he killed someone on that day many years ago, and all he could reply with was, "Test the DNA." Eventually, he did state that he wasn't there that night and he didn't do it. But again, he said it with a very blank face and didn't ask any questions. They arrested him and placed him in the back of the cop car, and on the drive from Manchester to Cedar Rapids, Detective Denlinger sat in the back with him, and he read him his rights before attempting to ask more questions. While on the drive, Detective Denlinger asked Jerry if he thought that this was possible that this happened and he just didn't remember it. And Jerry replied that he believed it was possible to do something like that and then block it out of your memories, which that's kind of a weird thing to say. And another thing to point out about this video from the nearly hour car ride back to Cedar Rapids is that Jerry never once said that he didn't do it or he didn't kill her. So let's talk briefly about Jerry Lynn Burns. He was born on December 23rd, 1953, and at the time of Michelle's murder, he was 25 years old. Like I mentioned earlier, he grew up in Manchester, Iowa, and he graduated from West Delaware High School in 1972. According to Wikipedia, he owned a powder coating business in Manchester. He had been married to a woman named Patricia, who died by suicide in 2008, and had three children with her. When Jerry's children learned the news of their father's arrest, they were shocked to hear that he was even considered a person of interest in such a horrific case. And to this day, they stand behind their dad and do not believe that he was involved in Michelle's murder. Jerry's family hired the prominent Iowa City lawyer named Leon Spies to represent him, and Leon says that there was no way that his client committed this murder. In February 2020, the trial got underway, and instead of being in Cedar Rapids, the judge granted a change in venue, and the trial was relocated to Davenport, Iowa. The prosecution put on an amazing display of evidence and called witnesses to testify, including Michelle's ex-boyfriend Andy Seidel and Mark Weirich, which was tough for both of these men. They also had put Kurt Thomas on the stand, who was the last known person to have seen Michelle alive. He told the details of the night and how she was so happy with her big smile as she waved goodbye. And I just want to say, and I know I kind of touched on it earlier, I really, really feel for Kurt. He was on the show Killer Cases for this case, and he talks about how Michelle's murder has absolutely consumed him. He talks about the amount of guilt he lives with every single day because he didn't walk Michelle out to her car that night. Kurt is filled with so many what ifs and believes that if he had walked her out, things would have turned out differently. And I know it's obvious, but I feel like I need to say it anyway. This was not Kurt's fault at all. Nobody knew that someone could be prowling the parking lot looking for an innocent victim to kill. It hurts my heart knowing that he is haunted by what happened that night and that he carries so much guilt over something that he had no way of knowing was going to happen. My heart just goes out to him so much. The last witness the prosecution put on the stand was a surprise and was an inmate that had been in the jail with Jerry named Michael Allison. Michael claimed that he and Jerry became close in jail, and they had become so close that Jerry referred to Michael as his son. He also autographed a newspaper for Michael where the front page story was about the Michelle Martinko case. Now, while on the stand, Michael told the jury that Jerry had allegedly told him that no matter what happens with his trial, he wins either way because he got the opportunity to live out in the world with his family as a free man for all those years. He also said that while the two were playing cards, Jerry had made a comment to Michael telling him that if he kept beating him at cards, he was going to have to take him to the mall. Now, jail informants will say a lot of things for a lot of different reasons, so take Michael Allison's testimony for what you will. The defense, however, was not trying to dispute that Jerry's DNA had been at the scene of the crime. They believed that it was, but they called their only defense witness to the stand named Dr. Michael Spence, who told the jury about the DNA transfer theory. He states that it's a possibility that the DNA could have been left behind by a transfer, meaning that the defense wanted the jury to believe that while Michelle had been shopping at the Westdale Mall, a place that Jerry Burns and his family had visited many times before, that Michelle had picked up his DNA off of something that she had touched. Whether it was something in a store or when she sat down in the food court, she touched something that he had previously touched, and that is how the DNA wound up on her dress. 9 days after the trial began, the prosecution and defense gave their closing arguments. The prosecution said that there was no way that the DNA was transferred like the defense claimed. And the defense said that there was no way that Jerry Burns, a married man and a father to 2 young children, had left his family on that night to drive to Cedar Rapids armed with a knife and rubber gloves to visit Westdale Mall to kill a random stranger before driving back home. Jerry Burns had no criminal history before or after this murder. He had no connection to Michelle Martinko. The defense said that he had no reason or motive to want to murder an innocent young woman. The jury was released to deliberate, and just after 3 hours, they finally reached their verdict: guilty of murder in the first degree. Here is where I want to mention some evidence that the prosecution was not allowed to show in court to the jury. And they felt like this evidence would have proved a motive. They found, after seizing Jerry's electronic devices, internet searches such as blonde molested after being strangled, as well as searches for sex with freshly dead person. Leon Spies, his defense attorney, successfully fought against the evidence being used in the trial, and he states that he didn't think that this was strong evidence of a motive. And with these searches not allowed in the trial, Spies was able to give that closing argument that there was no motive for his client to murder Michelle Martinko. I am curious to hear what you guys think about that tidbit that wasn't allowed to be used in court. Do you think that it proves that Jerry had a sexual motive for killing Michelle? Now, these internet searches did obviously take place well after Michelle's murder, but it does show that he was interested in some interesting things. Michelle Martinko fought for her life, and because of that, she likely caused Jerry Burns to slip with the knife, cutting himself, leaving behind his blood as well. She was a fighter until the end. Her sister and brother-in-law felt so much relief when the verdict was read, and it was a long, hard fight for them. 39 years is a long time to not have answers and to know that a killer is walking among them. Jerry's family, on the other hand, fully believe that he is innocent and that they got the wrong guy. They believe the transfer theory, or that it was a possibility that the Buick Michelle had been driving had been at the dealership where Jerry once worked, and that is how his DNA got on the gear shifter. But they 100% do not believe that he is guilty. With the verdict also came a lot of questions from people in the community. They started to wonder if other unsolved murders or disappearances happened to be related somehow to Jerry Burns. Detective Denlinger says that to this day he gets calls about other cases, and he is open to the idea that Jerry was potentially involved in other cases. One case that I saw that people speculate his involvement in is the mysterious disappearance of a young TV news anchor named Jody Huizentrude, who went missing in 1995. When I saw this theory that he was involved, I immediately got goosebumps. Jody went missing from Mason City, Iowa, 2 hours away from Manchester. And Michelle Martinko was murdered in Cedar Rapids, an hour away from Manchester. I don't feel like it's a far stretch to think that someone who is willing to drive an hour away to murder someone wouldn't be willing to drive 2 hours away to murder someone. And if you put a side-by-side picture of Jody and Michelle, I'm not going to lie, they kind of resemble each other. Both were beautiful young women with blonde hair and big, beautiful smiles. Like I said, I got goosebumps, and even now, talking about the possibility sends a chill down my spine. I have looked into Jody's case several times to cover for a Missing Monday, and after this has popped up, I feel like that's going to have to be my next Missing Monday case now. So be on the lookout for that, because I promise it is coming. I will say that there has been no evidence linking Jerry to Jody's case at this time. And I had seen that the Cedar Rapids Police Department won't comment on whether they're looking into it, but I also saw them say that they weren't looking into it either. So I'm not sure, but I do hope that whoever is in charge of Jody's case, they have considered him as a possibility. Because I have a hard time believing that someone who could violently murder someone like Jerry did to Michelle, I have a hard time believing that they have never killed again or even killed before. Now I have one more tidbit to add here that also blew my freaking mind. On December 19th, 2013, 34 years to the day after Michelle's murder, Jerry's cousin, Brian Burns, went missing. And his remains wouldn't be found for a full decade later when pheasant hunters found them in a field just a mile south of Brian's home in Manchester, Iowa. Now, the authorities have never said Jerry and Brian's disappearance were connected, but it really makes you wonder what the heck happened. Now, I have some theories that have zero evidence to back them on this part of the story, and I'll just keep those to myself, but holy moly, what a turn of events. So with the pandemic, Jerry's sentencing was postponed, and finally, on August 7th, 2020, he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Jerry has maintained his innocence, and in January of 2021, he hired the famous attorney Kathleen Zellner that represented Stephen Avery and is widely known for her role in the Making a Murder documentary on Netflix. According to the Des Moines Register, since then, Jerry has filed an appeal arguing that the police violated his constitutional rights in obtaining the DNA sample that ultimately tied him to blood found at the scene. His attempt to overturn his conviction was denied. Jerry Burns, who is now in his 70s, is currently serving his sentence at the Iowa Department of Corrections. And Michelle Martinko will forever be 18. A beautiful and vibrant young woman with the world at her fingertips, whose life was cut short before she could even graduate high school. Crimesters, make sure that you're a part of my private Facebook group. You can find it by searching Crime with Holly Podcast Discussion Group. In there, I share all information and pictures pertaining to the cases that I cover, and I also encourage all members to share all things true crime. You can find me on Instagram to keep up with what I'm doing in life, as well as see other true crime things that I share at Crimeaholly. And if you would like more true crime content, you can find me on TikTok at crimewithholly.podcast. If you're a Spotify listener, make sure you leave a comment about your thoughts on this case. And if you haven't yet, be sure to leave a review on your preferred podcast platform. Not only does it make my day to see you guys leaving a positive review, letting me know that you love the show, but it also helps me grow and helps others find the show as well. Thank you guys so much for listening to today's episode. Until next time, be aware and take care. Bye-bye.
Are you someone who watches every true crime documentary the day that it releases and then find yourself always wanting to know more, Googling the timelines, red flags, and then falling into the social media rabbit hole? Well, I'm here to do all of that for you, bringing the facts, theories, and details that no one else is covering on my hit true crime podcast, Serialistly with Annie Elise. Whether it's everything with the Idaho 4 case, now that the documents are unsealed, or shocking cases you've never heard of, packed with love triangles, cults, and twists you won't see coming. With over 1 million downloads a week, I break it down for you just like your best friend would. Serialistly with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.